Welcome once again, Rhetoric Warriors Podcast. We are here to add some sophistication to your rhetorical challenges out in the world. How do you use words in better ways to get people to believe better things? That sounded pretty good. I'll have to use that one again sometime.
I like it.
I am Dr. Dan, rhetorician, American comedian, comedy writer, founder of the Rhetoric Warriors. I'm the Rhetoric Warriors whip. I'm trying to get all the Rhetoric Warriors to get into the game. On the podcast, I talk to comedians about their politics and their social issues that they're dealing with. I talk to conservatives who need to be reminded that they're in a democracy and this is how it's supposed to work. And I talk to rhetoricians and persuaders. Once again, my friend Dave Payne is back. Denying his or belying his emeritus status to once again professor to the world. What's up?
What's up? I don't know. Your definition reminded me. I think it was the conservative thinker Richard Weaver that said, "Rhetoric shows us better images of ourselves." I always liked that, and I wonder if we employ that as a criterion for the soup we just crawled out of.
Yeah, we thought this time we'd, you know, since it just happened, we're
it's
a week
a good
out of the
standard.
Out of the midterms. Such an interesting election, so many things swirling around rhetorically. We thought we would do our own rhetoric postmortem autopsy, and you know, new Gollum life going forward on the midterms. So there's lots of issues here.
I think so. And a lot of it is, I guess, at the level of rhetoric or kind of meta about how we talk about politics. There seems to me to be a kind of a gap between the way that we think about them and dramatize them. Certainly a focus we've had is the media coverage. And I think more this time than ever, the gap between those expectations and what actually happened and our ability to describe and analyze them seems to be kind of in the wind, you know?
I mean, people have gone on to all the different explanation islands, right? After and say, well, was it just bad polling? Was it the Republicans had skewed the polling to make themselves look, you know, blown up more? Why did the polling fail? Why was it so off?
Well, I think polling and how we use polling is certainly one of those things that we're going to have to rethink. And of course, this has been true. Almost everything that has happened has been true in the last three elections, including polling, right? Since Donald Trump was originally elected. And the pollsters can always come back and say, well, there was nothing wrong with our polling. We said there's a margin of error here. And look at, you know, you're within the margin of error. Clearly, it's in the way we use those polls, certainly in the way some questions about the way those polls are conducted are coming to the fore. You know, if you average out 14 biased polls, they're still biased.
Right.
I thought it was interesting. Mitch came out and said, well, the polls we were looking at weren't predicting any red wave. Well, yeah, now you tell us.
Right.
So I think the polling became part of the dramaturgy of media, more World Federation Wrestling kind of coverage than, and as is kind of the win-loss, the need to even explain what happened. My reflex was this is almost exactly what's happened in the last three elections. The battle lines have been drawn. People are not budging a hell of a lot one way or another. You may find some real little sub pockets. Okay, the Latinos are not as much Democrat as they were. And yes, I think we'll probably find out more young people came out to vote. More Black men defected to conservatism. You know, some very small movements that were easily replaced by other kinds of movements.
Right.
When it comes down to it, the actual percentages, well, not one incumbent senator lost her or his job.
Well, that's the whole Politburo, right?
So for all of the, and to think about, you know, the kind of the Republicans needing to explain their failure, the Democrats, you know, oh, wow, what a victory. we defeated them. We pushed back the red wave.
Right.
For all of that. You know, think about 6 months ago, the Democrats were sure that they would trounce the Republicans this time around because of all the, you know, abortion and all the other issues. People might have a way to maintain this equilibrium. And I think it's that equilibrium that we have to.
So if you were attacking this, then if we use the two camps of there's the information world, right? So statistics and polls and predictions, yada, yada, yada. And then there's the narrativity world of, hey, you know, it's the fascists coming in and you're saving democracy. You know, which camp are we going to work if we're going forward now? We're like, okay, look, we really need the narrativity to continue to heighten. You know, that's where the win is. Or do we go back into the polls, or we just say that's wasted effort? The information work is wasted effort.
Right. And what we seem to be, the reason I called it soup is we seem to be adrift in a vat of all of the heteroglossia of all of those things, right? There's this narrative, inspirational, historical cusp stuff going on. This is the last, final, biggest election to save democracy. At the same time, what do we hear echoing? Well, history right. predicts. And of course, a lot of the boundaries of this thing were this kind of fall history about, you know. And so you know, and what is that history based on and what can it tell us? So I think the way we use history in this rhetoric is certainly another thing to rethink, right? History got tossed out of the window 6 years ago, as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
Party politics have been tossed out of the window, and both sides, I've harangued you about this many times. Neither side wants to give up because that's their way of claiming credit for whatever happened, right? We'll make the attribution. They elect us because they agree with everything that we think, when your own people don't agree with everything that you think, right?
Right. Yeah, I look at it like today, you know, Pelosi coming out and saying she's no longer going to be the speaker, and the first day with any kind of public voice, the Republicans going right after Hunter Biden, you know, and right after the Biden crime syndicate. It's like a cartoon version of politics that the Republicans want to play with. You know, they're like, well, here are the toys and we're just going to run these. We have nothing else. You know, the border, fentanyl. MTG got up and actually got to speak today, which was just horrendous to watch if you watch any of that stuff. But
I didn't partake.
But it's like the clowns, you know, have retaken the forum.
Right. And nobody said, gee, you know, we returned a lot of clowns to Congress this time. That's to me one of the things that really attenuates the sense of victory. But think how many really crazy people got elected.
But isn't that support for dramaturgy that the clowns can get up there and just be clownery and characters, and they can, you know, haul up their clown villains from the left? And
well,
just...
if your audience is well versed in the traditions of kabuki, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I guess this is your project. You know, how do I teach them the kabuki mask reading of our culture? Where is there in my vocabulary for an MTG, right? That's, you know, space lasers. And
right.
We have, you know, I mean, there clearly there needs to be something better. And I guess this is the comic view that you're going to help us with. But there needs to be something better than saying, oh, my God. But, you know, once again, they're talking about the, well, you know, people are talking, well, Florida, look at how, you know, and it is
Yeah, you're down there in the
that in a few short years we went from purple to bright red. At the same time, the Georgian that I'm speaking with, half of the people walking around here did not vote for Herschel Walker. Whatever else may be true,
right?
So yeah, it's they're, you know, and I guess maybe that's one of the reasons for so much of this. Heteroglot is the sense making apparatuses are still very challenged.
Right. And I think that heteroglossy is a great way of looking at it. Like if you look at this, the gaming board, right? Like here's the political gaming board and it folds in half. So here's the, you know, here's the left and here's the right and kind of a little bit there in the middle. And you look at the villains over here and the heroes over here. And you look at the different ways that the little pieces are moved around. I think like when people saw Lauren Boebert maybe getting kicked out, like, oh, one of our little clown figures with guns and Christmas cards might be off the board.
Sure. And, you know, and once again, I think we got to cheer for that. So, and that is kind of the where we're at here, right? The All-Star wrestler got pitched into the stand there, but they are coming back. It's not over.
Right.
But yeah, if you win the national championship by 1 point, you get to wear the t-shirt and the hat and claim to be champion. But the other guys are still pretty good.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a game again next year.
Yeah. So, it's like I used to always say they call it the NBA finals, but then they come back and play it again next year.
Sorry,
not that much final about it at all.
Like, you know, this is like the invasion of Ukraine. Wow, the Soviets didn't blitzkrieg Kyiv, and right, but we're still going to be get shot with missiles every day for a long. There's still a long war ahead here, right?
Right.
So there is some relief, but gee, I would hate to see anybody get too relaxed about this situation.
Well, I'd really like to, let's stay on this heteroglossia because it's okay. Interesting with, I think with digital media and cable media needing so much content, right? Heteroglossia plays into that very well because now you've got, I saw somebody posted on Twitter, it's like enough of politics. There's no way in hell I should know anything about the 4th District in Virginia. You know, I should be upset about that. And so, somehow I am. And just this idea that the board becomes expansive and everybody's going back to that same board and poaching for stories and for content and characters.
Well, sure. And if you think about the full board here, and you know, it is an environment that sustains a lot of, you know, QAnon is itself a heteroglossy.
Right.
Right. It just sort of, and these things don't have to cohere with each other. They just... No. That they're picked up, they're seized for a while. And if they're disproven radically or proven to be, you know, or they just wear out, I think is probably what happens, they recede. So and I think that is another thing to note that probably isn't it, that I don't hear in the win-loss tally is, although there wasn't a lot of political change in people's alignments, and I think that phenomenon needs to be looked at in and of itself, we didn't hear a lot of, you know, insurrection talk, at least not yet. So I think maybe the Jan 6 hearings probably had a way of just sort of making that drama nothing anybody wants to really engage in anymore. Right?
Yeah, and that's one of the things I had thought about this. Like, what is, like with the Trumpism and the MAGA coming back around, is it spent? Like, how much gas is left in that tank? Everybody's heard it. Trump's, you know, announcement the other day was the most undramatic, unreceptive, you know, piece of
discourse he's ever done. Done that, you know. I think that, and it didn't lead to much except, you know, some people going to jail and maybe not the right ones. It does seem to be tired. I don't sense, and maybe that is the big sigh of relief on the Democrats side. It's, the election is the election.
Right. So well, far. And I think I saw this going through the Trump basically just cycles through rhetorics that haven't been used that much in America. Right. He reanimates them, gets as much juice as he can and goes to the next one. And my question was always watching like the Black Lives Matter protests and things is he going to go full authoritarian and start putting bodies on the ground? And he was close, but that's the one narrative that they haven't gone to of, oh, there's violence. Like if Pence had gotten hung, you know, on January 6th, then he could have sent in the military and decimated everybody and been like, yeah, you can't kill my vice president. And that's that, you know, playbook, that full authoritarian violence playbook. And I don't think the other thing I was noting is that all the election deniers who lost, they weren't in office this time. So they didn't have any power to do anything. Like Carrie Lake in Arizona is the one who's holding on with her, you know, glossy fingernails and won't let go. And it's like today, she's like, I'm, you know, taking this all the way to the courts, Supreme Courts. And everybody's like, yeah, yeah, great. But you're not the governor right now. So who cares? You know?
Right. I guess we'll see whether, I mean, it's stuff still going on. I mean, I just kind of one of these little daily digest sort of things that a judge in Kansas threw out a lawsuit to redo the 2020 election. They're still out there.
Yeah, they're still bringing it up to courts, but it's not like Trump was president. Right. So when he was fomenting rebellion and insurgency, there's some real resources there. Like, it always amazed me that he didn't actually go full Blackwater and send in real special ops to do that, you know, that event. And that's where I think that's where he basically lost. He sent the amateurs in. And so if you look at these guys and like, okay, if the tank is spent and you can see it in Trump's eyes, like, ah, my stuff's not hitting anymore, what else has he got? Yeah.
Well, his capacity to be aware of that. I mean, the reporting seems to suggest that there's at least two Donald Trumps. At least there's a high vacillation that has attended his particular personality disorder. So that he knew he had lost and was grieving for the loss. And, oh, gee, I don't want anybody to find out we lost. And then at the next moment, he was all exhilarated with the possibility of you know.
Sure.
So he's a pretty morally and psychologically flexible individual.
Yeah, he he's Madonna of politics. Madonna would simply appropriate the next, you know, sub-style culture that had come along. So
he's been my pillow of politics. He takes the shape of whoever sat on it last, basically.
Yeah, kind of, you know, and you watch that, like even Madonna is a great example, I think, of somebody who's just an appropriator and a really good one, you know, all the way from the things that she was grabbing from her teenage years up till now, sure. Where now she's tried to move her into hip hop. So she's like, you know, blown out her face and she's got gold teeth and all this stuff. And you're like, what's going on now? But I think Trump has gone through the same cycling. The question is now, like the big lie, he landed on the big lie because he got some narcissistic juice out of it, you know, and they talk about the narcissistic depletion, you know, now that he's lost the elections. But the problem with the big lie is that it's kind of investigatable, like even from what Americans will accept for quantitative proof, you can disprove it.
Well,
mostly more,
even after, you know, once again, I think the Jan 6 election or hearings probably
stole his thunder. You think they
ameliorated that movement to some extent, although a lot of people didn't watch it. But more people at the end of that believe that the election was stolen than at the beginning of that. So what is real and what is true and what counts as proof are all, you know. Those are dicey things, and I do think it's part of the narcissistic. And I say this not as a clinician at all, of course, but the parallel cases that I've observed in my life, those people tend to hang in there without very much evidence, right, or support, because they're trapped between zero and one. The zero is unthinkable.
Yeah, there's no win at all over there. If you give up, there's zero win.
And I think it's because they've achieved a certain, a perfect balance between hero and victim. So that anything that happens that dispels my heroism is more evidence of my victimology. Both keep you at the center of the narrative. So I think, you know, he will go to his grave an aggrieved person. But.
Well, I'm curious what you think about the sub-stories, his, you know, his minions, and the way that they mostly lost. With like Fetterman Oz, I thought was a really interesting one, because to me, Fetterman is one of those guys who understands the kind of history of Democrats, which is working class. You're supposed to be a big goofy dude or whatever. You're not supposed to be the Obama educated, you know, refined stylistic effete. You're not supposed to be that as a Democrat. And I think in some ways I watched him kind of harken back to that stuff. Which may be a way of grabbing back some of the working class from the Republicans.
You know, I've heard that analysis, although Fetterman wasn't kind of the point of all that. He is an interesting character in that regard. Something just today, even that the kind of the pandemic brought a pushback toward labor rights again. So that, you know, how that manifests itself politically. Because the big analysis, and I think accurate about the problem that the Democrats have had, is they lost labor.
Right.
And became, you know, the party of graduate degrees and the ultra poor. and the ultra poor aren't voting. So it's become a problem, right?
Well, and subgroups, you know, they're the party of many, many subgroups.
Right. So to that extent, but you know, in the locale of Pennsylvania, come on, not only is the working class Democrat a much bigger trope and icon there, but Oz, you know, I mean, maybe Walker will lose. So we can say, okay, the Trump candidates lost very narrowly. For a guy that never had more than 42% approval rating, I'm not sure we can count this as, you know, there's still something going on there, and it isn't really about Trump. And I think that's the untold story here is the factor of just denying liberals and Democrats. The villainization of both sides of the parties is maybe the real story to me is the Republicans have been doing it for 40 years, getting good at it. I mean, if you look back some sort of history here, an alternative history, seems to me that one thing that has changed, I mean, I recall teaching years and years ago, and I remember in the 1988 election, Dukakis and Bush Sr., right? And I would talk to my students, and the big thing that was being said by everybody is, there are no issues here, there are no issues. So one day I just started writing on the board, okay, let's take an issue. And we filled the entire board, there were millions of issues. None of them were really very dramatic or involving, especially for the group of people I was talking to, right? And so when you think about the political consensus that we say we think we want now, an end to this divisiveness, as though it were a terrible thing, or disabling thing. It was really this kind of taken for granted. Yeah, all those issues there, and frankly, I think they're important issues. Anybody politically charged think they're important issues. A lot of important stuff happened as a result of these elections. Or if you think about the 2000 election between Bush and Gore, the only issue they kept talking about over and over again was how we're going to spend the $10 billion surplus that was projected. Which went out the window like within 20 minutes.
Right. Yeah.
Gore just kept repeating, he's going to blow a hole in the economy. So really what is true back then is a kind of an apolitical taken for granted that seems to have systematically kind of eroded. Think about the issues here really do matter, and there's a lot at stake, and there are more people, you know, involved in that, thinking that they have a lot at stake in this.
Well, so, and I sometimes,
but it's achieved a kind of a parity, an equalization.
Right.
So both sides seem to have that, and I think if this election moved anything, more people kind of entered that thinking they had something to lose here.
Well, I think it's the politics of politics, right? That we are now being forced to be aware that politics is a thing, and that you probably, if you don't participate, you're going to get some grief from your kids, from people around you. So it's the sense of America, I don't know, like has now been forced into a political awareness space that it never had. That doesn't mean educated, just aware that politics is a thing, you know. And I see this a lot, even with my kids. Sure. You know, they're not particularly politically engaged, but they, you know, they get the big signals that come through it. They get the big lobbed, you know, bombs across the fence about what's happening, and they'll get charged up for a little while, and then they'll get exhausted. So, you know, eventually, does this rhetorically change the audience where we start to get aware of the heteroglossia board and how to meter out your energy, you know, across? Because now, like the Warnock-Walker election, you need another month of energy. Like, can you make people still care after this, you know, big explosion of caring or pseudo-caring for a while?
Well, I think that's right. I think that people want to return to an apolitical, particularly the left-leaning, that they draw less sustenance out of that, right? That constant fear. They want to take it for granted. Look at how abortion was handled. They didn't protest until 6 months later when they actually did. We knew 6 months ahead of time this is what was going to happen. And I think, you know, in a way, I talked about the battle lines being drawn. We knew in the last election abortion was on the table. We knew the election before. You know, people who pay attention knew when Hillary Clinton wasn't elected that we were in serious danger here, right? That was on the ballot then. But people, once again, it's the great taken for granted. But I think right. The point's right on is this sort of constant morphology and the heteroglossia. I mean, you know, I don't think it's strategic and conscious, but I do think Trump's pathology plays right in. He is a heteroglot.
Oh, for sure.
He's like the guy in the Name of the Rose. Right. You say he just picks up a lot of narratives and issues. Yeah. I mean, he really didn't generate any of them. He just picked up all these sort of water cooler kinds of folk crap and said it out loud. So people go, wow, finally my leader.
Right. Well, I had a thing early on with Trump. I had a sort of a 10-part analysis of him back when I was actually creating written content about him that, you know, if you look at his history, the fact that he was a trained actor, he knows how to run script. You know, it's not like a dramatic actor, but he's a reality show. He's a self actor. He knows how to be inauthentic. Authentically inauthentic.
He knows how to play a role.
So he's got that. And like with actor chops, with Hollywood chops, he's been around that stuff a lot. You even hear when he does his speeches, he's directing. He's like asking for, you know, camera angles and stuff like this. And most politicians don't bring that in. It's like Carrie Lake brought that because she had been on the news. You know, they made fun of her about her filter, you know, that she had appeared on, you know, any kind of digital media, but she knows the game, you know? And so if you look at the things that Trump does, it really is that, how do I exist in heteroglossia? How do I constantly adjust and shift? There's no center. The center doesn't have to hold it all. I just need the right discourse.
Right. Just keep it alive for that news cycle. I think instinctively, you know, as a shapeshifter, he does that. But I was, you know, connecting that to your analysis that's kind of the political arena, that we may get all charged up about abortion, but it doesn't remain part of the motivational, you know, for a significant other population. And something in what we were saying too, let's not confuse the necessary politicization of more and more people in the public. I mean, half the people still don't vote, but let's not confuse that with the kind of dramaturgy that's going on MSNBC or Fox News. Very few people are in those kinds of, you know, extreme attention. So sustaining that across time, although, you know, we're more and more that those groups are junkies for it, right?
So. Yeah, and it was really interesting. Again, I think from an emotional response narrativity perspective of consuming this stuff, of being in watching MSNBC and CNN and going back and forth to get the hit, you know, the heroin hit of, oh my God, we've actually won this time, versus right. This is why I don't watch sports, because I know I'm being manipulated into these very intense, you know, positive and negative emotions, and I don't like that roller coaster. But this one was satisfying. You know, it's like, look at this, we're winning. Hey, how sure. about that? Maybe that's enough kind of
we're addiction. Not losing. Yes.
Maybe that's enough of an addiction to keep the left coming out more and more. It's like, hey, remember how good it felt to win? You know.
Well, I think once again, it is, you know, more and more people on the left are kind of adopting the posture of the extremists on the right. It's, you know, an equal and opposite kind of motivation.
What do you mean when you say that?
Well, that they're having to engage at the same level of the drama and villainize the opposition. You know, basically the symptoms of groupthink, constantly, you know, over-dramatizing because these, you know, and we can't really, you know, it does seem like, gee, these are really bad people and they're really bad things that they want from the point of view. So it's not like the issues or the stakes are not real. But once again, we can't, what's changed is we just can't really trust the system to, you know, diffuse all of that. I mean, you know, once again, come January 6th or whatever, you know, the Hunter Biden Benghazi show begins.
It's amazing. I watch this stuff. And so if you look at, again, if we are the big rhetoricians moving the pieces around on the board, like, okay, I need villains for my lefties to charge them up. And you look at the list, the roll call of what makes a conservative villain. All right. So Jim, what's his face? I was going to say Jim Jones, Jim Jordan, you know, so right. Let's break him down as a villain because he's been off the board mostly for the last 2 years. They've kept him off the committees. You know, they tried to put him on the January 6th committee and she's like, no.
Right.
That ain't happening. And so he's been off the board. Today he popped back up on the board. So his stupid square, stupid face was right there on my screen again today. And I'm like, I'm going to have to watch this idiot for two years because they're going to news cycle him. So what makes him the villain? Like, if you're going to play him up and be like, you want that in Congress again? You know, if we have our list of characters. You know,
he's part of the clown car, right? I mean, that he's got his own kind of outrageous, you know, the same things that make him a hero to a certain group of people, I suppose, that he's willing to, you know, do outrageous things. And
his outspokenness, it doesn't matter what the content is, right? Ron Johnson did it yesterday with the same thing. It's like, you're going to run over everybody, ignore, you know, all the polity and all the, you know, all the courtesy.
We could ask it from his point of view. How else do you get attention when you have so little talent?
Yeah, well, I used to tell people Trump basically in business, what I see of his theory in business is to get involved somehow, doesn't matter how, and then just become such a problem for all the reasonable partners that they'll pay him to leave.
You know, back in the old days, processing the 60s, there was a book on the rhetoric of agitation and control. And of course, the yuppies and yippies and hippies and yippies and whatever were seen as the agitators, that their political strategy was constant agitation. Think about Abby Hoffman. Think about, you know, Chicago 7, being outrageous, throwing norms back in the face.
Right.
Are we not in agitation and control? These are
That's exactly it.
And of course, the now enfranchised 401k, looking forward to a peaceful retirement, grandparent yippies and hippies are going, you know, they're in the control seat. And we don't like you taking shit out of control. So anyway, it just doesn't look like the same stuff because you right. have a sense of right and wrong.
Well, and you see this, I've always looked at the logic, you know, the amoral logic of appropriation, right? And this is within the genius of capitalism. You see somebody else doing something that works, grab it, do it. You know, and that grab it, do it, I see it all the time in business where instead of thinking to new strategies, new tactics, they just look around and kind of see what the leaders are doing in the industry. And like, do that, you know, and that becomes a thing that you can get sign off on. Grab that, do it, replicate it, and go. And by the time you get it up and going, it doesn't have the same strength. But in politics, man, there's no production structure really needed. Like, it's all, you know, do a news conference and say it. It's like, wow, that was an instant appropriation.
Well, sure. If I understand what you're saying is that because it is public drama, these are sociological processes that go way back. And we are all actively completing the scripts as we go along, right? So we kind of know what, you know, we don't have to have a complete script for this stuff. We will revise whatever it has happened in relationship to sustaining the ongoing drama. It's sort of like this is a political process that's kind of in our bones. That isn't to say it doesn't change. And, you know, I think that we need to be, once again, I think a lot has changed here. And this sort of casual use of history. Historically at the midterm, you know, the other party went, well, you know, that's partially because of this great taking for granted that the sense that there is no real difference between Democrats and Republicans. And And I heard this invoked. I heard this invoked by people on the right this time. Oh, well, this is the reason for the red wave, is that they're unhappy about the prices of groceries, they're unhappy about the price of gas, and they're going to throw the bums out. And indeed, the throw the bums out warrant was in what elected Trump to begin with. It wasn't
right.
It wasn't agreement with Trump. You know, not a wholesale agreement by any means. It developed into some holistic different kinds of social movement, or quasi-religious movement. But you know, maybe that's what died. Is, oh wow, there are consequences to this. Nobody's playing the throw the bums out. So they may not like Biden. Or you know, certainly if you look at just within the context of the Democratic Party, another kind of conclusion being foisted about these days is that, well, people within the parties, because of this polarization or calcification in the opposition, are more homogenous in their beliefs within the party. I don't think that's true at all. I don't think there are that many, you know, the people, clearly there are far more people voting Republican. Just look at Herschel Walker or Oz. Why would that many people vote for such a person, right? Down the row here, you know, Trump clearly was able to get 49% of the vote with never having more than 42% of approval. And that's true of Biden too, as it turns out. That you know, the progressives, they just can't afford to try the other side.
Right. Well, then is the real rhetoric war going on then? Sometimes I break it down to just the size of the symbology. So big symbols over here, the mega symbols of your party, blue and liberal and anti-red and anti-conservative, versus, you know, the PICO, which is the details, the policies. Like, I think I've watched Biden use this strategy a little bit over the last few months of detailing his accomplishments. You know, I think that's traditional politics, like when people are actually parsing out what you've done and the policies and what your votes are and things like that. That's sort of PICO level information. And I see him wanting to bring that back up into the mega level of awareness. So he can point out to everybody, look, you know, it makes a difference electing people who govern. And he's a 40-year governor. You know, he knows what politics needs to do to sort of deliver at the level of, you know, lived experience, versus people that are just playing the clown game. They have no policies. They're not going to do anything for you. You know, it's just a show so they can continue the window of the grift. You know, and it's interesting to me to watch people get lost in the PICO and me go, I don't know if anybody's listening to any of your PICO level information here. You know, spending your messaging time on that versus, you know, I think Biden was pretty good at this, of, you know, just pointing at Trump and saying, hey, you know, shut this clown down. You know, hitting him with a few bombs and then moving off of him.
Yeah. Right. You know, I think you're right. It's hard to know. I mean, that's why these rhetorics are layered for different audiences and different entrance points for these audiences.
But I think like Hunter Biden's a good example. Like the right has decided that this is a mega level, you know, nuclear missile. And they are going to make it explode. They're like hammering that, like it landed and it thudded. And they're like just hammering at the warheads. Like, come on, you know, this is going to explode. You know, the whole idea of literally going after the Ukraine, as, you know, with the Russian propaganda of, as the location of the Nazis. That's where the Nazis went. And I'm like, are you really going to hammer at that warhead and try to turn that, you know, rhetoric on for people as this big beacon that they can all look at? And you see the crazies adopt it pretty quickly because they'll adopt anything. Right. But can you get that into the core consciousness of any semi-reasonable person?
Well, there's that semi-reasonable, you know, what is the threshold here? Apparently, I heard some commentator said, I've been monitoring Russian TV. You wouldn't believe what they're telling them. It's, you know, it's just unbelievable. And you know, despite the fact that we are insulated in our own bubble, that probably the majority of Russians really think that, you know, that's what's going on over there. Now, we report, of course, oh, there's interior dissent. There are people, you know, Putin seems to know what he's doing. And clearly, how do you keep evangelicals who are the problem on the Democrat side in terms of young people and poor people basically don't want to have to attend to this stuff,
right? Yeah, have other things,
you know, for different reasons perhaps. Yeah. but how do you keep them agitated? Look, on the other side, the evangelicals are basically not that political, although they've been, you know, preached into it certainly. But how are you going to keep them whipped up? Well, you know, the Hunter Biden, and you can sit over here from your own, you know, side and go, well, what about Trump?
You know? Right.
Well, we've already worked that out. We've already worked that out, that the Lord works in strange ways, and he's you know, he's brought Trump to be the.
Well, I kind of had the thought the other night about maybe this is the 50-year brainchild of, you know, whoever was pushing Reagan through the system and Gorbachev through the system, of it looking like, you know, they built this dramaturgy years and years ago. Tear down that wall, Mr. Gorbachev. You know, like, it's a big win for freedom. And really what it was a big win for propaganda, you know, highly prestigious, super sophisticated. It let it out. And it was some kind of agreement between the oligarchs of America and Russia. Like, hey, we let you out of here. You need to get those techniques over here so we can use that to dominate this country.
Yeah, well, oligarchs, insofar as they had the money to purchase the technology. I think these are media related as much as, I mean, if you, you know, and you can go back to any era in the 20th century, and the mass medium of the times is surprising us with its ability to, you know, make it appear as there's huge numbers of people thinking one thing or doing one thing, right? Or getting people to respond to messages. If you look at the basic Republican playbook in terms of the stuff that Trump's doing with a lot, like, as you pointed out, a lot more panache, certainly a lot less class, and maybe that's, you know.
That's America.
That's an appealing
thing. That goes back to the Fetterman thing. Wearing
he's
a hoodie.
The Sanford and Sons of Republican propaganda.
If I had to invest in a rhetoric, you're not going to find me often going against, hey, working class this shit up and see how America likes it.
And he's such an unlikely candidate to embody all of that. But nonetheless, the amazing abstract abilities of identification are huge.
Oh,
anyway, yeah. The playbook goes back to Richard Nixon. Sure. Certainly Reagan was an improvement. And if you go back there, you know, I used to, like I said, I teach this stuff. So there's all kinds of, Bill Moyers did a lot of series of tapes on the public mind. They're good stuff because they're interviewing all these guys that basically engineered Reaganism. And they're all pretty much saying, yeah, here's how we did it. We were hip to the fact that the image was more powerful than the written word. People, you know, you could have a story here about Ronald Reagan breaking unions and having a picture of him hoisting a beer with the workers. It was the beer with the workers that won every time. So you know, this is, you know, media drama is certainly the kind of the one unifying. And of course, the breaking into the cable news networks and the,
yeah, selective exposure,
perception, interpretation has only further, you know, helped create the bubbles.
Well, and I think that's a really good insight. Like Reagan, you know, was in an area where it wasn't quite heteroglossia yet, and you could build a big cover story narrative and hold it together. I've even seen people try to go back in and, you know, start to decry the Reagan actuality.
But think about Make America Great Again. Wasn't that what Nixon was telling us we needed to do?
Yeah, I mean, that was a Reagan slogan. He used that slogan.
Absolutely.
But it's that sense now with, so in heteroglossia board versus like the big, you know, sort of TV had gotten to the production quality at that point with Reagan, where you could have a dramatic actor and it made a huge difference. But it wasn't now with this kind of, you know, death by a billion, you know, cameras. And so when you look at it now, and you're like, okay, if I'm again trying to thread my rhetoric through all of this to get to a voter down here who might change their mind, you know, what am I sending their way? I can only get their attention for three seconds.
Well, I think one strategy is Benghazi. Hunter Biden, repeated over and over and over.
Big crime,
over
big sin.
And keep, you know, let that be kind of a lint ball flowing through this, you know, that's going to collect by association all of these things.
Do you think they'll pull Benghazi back out of mothballs? That actual one?
I think Hunter Biden is just Benghazi, you know, 0.20.
It's a scandal.
But, you know, I think these things don't go away. I think they're still trying to imprison Hillary. I still think I think those things do not really go away because they're, you know, they're memories of
they're echoes. There's echoes of that stuff, but they need fresh ones, right? In order for this, at the beginning, like, is the gas tank?
But once again, there can't just be one thing, right? So I think, you know, on the other side, you know, and it is perceived that way, I think, by the people on the conservative side. January 6th. I mean, that's they think that's Benghazi. And the longer it lives, the more they're able to sort of round off the sharp edges. Oh, Buffalo Shaman, he was really a nice guy. He was convicted for carrying a flagpole. You know what? I mean, I've heard this, right?
Yeah.
These things all kind of, you know, get rationalized, you know, literally.
Well, there's a thing in marketing of quality through quantity, which essentially is you overwhelm the algorithm, you overwhelm the audience and the target audience by just so much messaging until you see the ones that flame up, and then you just replicate that. And so when I think about the Republicans and their, I don't know, is it their internal polling on Hunter Biden that says, hey, we'll have to keep running this for a while longer, but it does have some stickiness. It has some glue. People, at least you can't hit Biden with anything else, right? Biden has no other, he's left himself no other chinks in his armor. You know, they try to pull up the Anita Hill for a while. You know, the gaffes, the fact that he's old is probably his biggest chink in his armor right now. But even that, he keeps showing, you know, competence in front of cameras, at least to the point where you can't say, oh, he's doddering completely. So what are you going to hit him with, you know, that will stick? And I think that sort of, again, death by a thousand cuts until you find a deep wound. And then you just, I mean, the amount of salt they can pour into a single wound is just endless.
Well, I think once again, it's just one, you sort of sketch this gurgling cauldron of narrative seed, you know, partial, right? Incomplete little ghosts or whatever they are, I think you're right. You can just pick up on one and go with it, or you can kind of merge them into each other. But you can also keep some going. Though you're talking about, you know, advertising and marketing. You know, they'll play a full ad, a full 60-second ad, until, you know, 8 billion times, and then they'll cut that down to 30 seconds where you only see part of it. And then eventually they'll cut it down to 15 seconds. Where, you know, so that the life of the ad, it can always be evoked,
right,
with just a gesture toward it. Well, basically our symbols all kind of work that way, right? They're latent once again in the what you got to do is get people to actively engage in the process of rationalizing these things out, so that when Trump's getting, you know, arrested, which people are still on the one side thinking has got to happen here for his misuse of classified document. Oh, we're on the other side. We've got Hillary's emails. I mean, this is another rhetorical function that I know that we've come, the great, you know, the equivocation, other sideism. I can't hear you any longer. I've lost audio. I don't think I did anything. Can you hear me?
I think it's me, but I'm not sure why.
You're back. You're back. Mm-hmm. All right, now you're gone.
Hello, hello, hello?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I got some loose wires or something. I was kind of getting some bad feedback from it. What were we saying? Tough moment for two old guys.
Well, we were talking about just I was talking about, both side-ism, how-about-ism, right? The strategy that these things shards all remain latent around there and can kind of offset anything that, so it diffuses all of these kinds of moral crises. And that's kind of a dialectic that we seem to have going on, is the sort of the moral hand-wringing of the liberals and the relishment in that and the sort of, amoralization of all these things on the other side.
Well, I think I was talking about the exhaustion of, the story and getting to the sense of how do you reanimate these things? How do you reanimate, Hillary's emails? How do you make the documents? Like, Trump will exhaust everybody. He delays and delays and delays and watches things lose their sin, lose the level of criminality. Right. And he throws up all sorts of smoke bombs all over the place. And you watch him use it over and over and over and over and over again. And there's not enough teeth in the judicial system to drag his taxes out.
What a saga.
It's just shown you the sheer ineffectuality of the justice system, period. I think in the way it's set up against the other.
It's just so slow, one thing.
It's so slow, but then once
the taxes were ordered to be released and Judge Roberts stays this temporarily for Trump to do appeal.
Yeah, and like Bannon, Bannon was indicted, was going to jail, and bam, oh, he's not. Sorry.
Yeah.
That's kind of an amazing, again, on the chessboard of federal judges, Supreme Court judges, and all this stuff, if you're moving them around, how do you make
this? Well, yeah, I have to think this is in part, massive corruption meeting politics. I think if we just looked at these as strategies that corrupt criminals use, for a long period of time, Trump learned it all from his daddy or whatever.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. These are all mobster plays. I mean, right. They're very classical mobster plays, like showing up, in court, when you actually have to show up in court in a wheelchair. I think Rudy Giuliani did that, right? I mean, these are classic mobster plays.
I wouldn't doubt it, yeah.
But when you watch this stuff and being played out in real time, you're like, okay, how do I counter-program this? Like, coming in at it with civility and rationality and all that is just totally ineffectual. So, like, we're playing story games with these guys, and, like, I need to up their villainy always. That is the game now. It's just stories, and how do I break, my people's...
Well, once again, it's just another variation on the agitation control that, and the kind of the monomyth of the outlaw in American culture. The more of an outlaw he is, the more some people think that's...
Yeah, and that's
the right response to government.
I don't know the percentage of Trump that is, but that's a large percentage of his
followers. No kidding. It doesn't pay his taxes. Wow, how smart is that? I mean, that was kind of Trump's original line, I think. Well, so, do you really want to counter that? I mean, are you really willing to throw in to, we want some sort of counter tribalism here, or do we really want, is it working? I guess this is maybe something to ask on the cusp of this election. Is it working to kind of counter that with, don't you really want to defend our institutions and the rule of law and rationality and order?
Well, maybe that's it, making government and governance itself a stronger character. Because I think Trump was very clear with the Bannon agenda of coming in and destroying the institutions so that they had no inner, competition for power. And I think because he's been in government for so long, clearly Biden respects all of these institutions and has built them back up. Like he's at the...
Well, he's just such a perfect product of them,
Right. He's perfectly
all of it. I think the thing that he shares with Trump, he's not a particularly greatly talented individual. He's a morally good person doing all the right things, but he's really a product of that system in so many ways. Oozes out of him, right? Which is why the stain of Hunter is such an awful.
Yeah, he's got this hump. It's a little hump on his back.
Right now, absolutely.
It's still just a tiny little bump, and they want to make it a... Yeah. But I watched him in 2020 and how seamlessly he moved amongst those people. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, we've been doing this with you for 4 years. It's not some bellicostic, you know, Trump child walking in here and going, they're all going, hey, we're on the top of the food chain. We don't need to do that.
And for all of the, you know, discounting him, I watched the news conference after the election. He was perfectly lucid. Absolutely crystal clear. And his responses to reporters were about as good as we've seen. You know, in their own way, better than Obama, because, you know, Obama always answered intelligently, but not always, you know, accessibly. So he's a perfect, and I think that's what got him elected.
Yeah.
Is that he's a return to normal. He's sort of.
Well, maybe, and that's it. Like Reagan comes in, and the first thing Reagan says, like they were showing Reagan quotes to me all week long for some reason on social media, saying, you know, the worst things that you can hear is I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Right.
And his anti-government, I want to be the, you know, the president who hates government. And the fact of turning government into a villain for 40 years, I think Biden in some ways has kind of gone back around the back door and gone, you know what? Look what government did for you. We sent you all this money during the COVID. We sent you, you know, all this government stuff. So maybe that's a big play, you know, for the Democrats for the next 2 years to really create the hero of government again.
Well, I think that is what they've been doing. And maybe not always as effectively, you know, I think they could. And you talked about the information stuff that nobody really wants or too many people don't really want. But a lot of these things really need some explanation and to be given some history. You know, the student loan thing, I guess, is close to because I've spent my life in academia and I see all the dimensions of whatever happened to funding. And, you know, I essentially was educated for free.
Yeah, me too.
My first college tuition was like $200 a semester. That's free.
Yeah, I posted the most popular comment I ever made on somebody else's post was when I started in 81, Reagan had just gotten elected. And for 2 years, I was going to college and making money because of grants. And then the last 2 years, I ended up paying like the last year's like $8,000 a semester, you know, or for the year. And I'm like, I was the last working class, you know, that snuck in under, you know, the world that says, hey, educated people make a much better country. So maybe we ought to make that really accessible.
Absolutely. Of course, that has always been an issue, I think, on the right. But at any rate, there's a lot of things that could have been, the population could have been better prepared for understanding why this was not some sort of elitist move. But, you know, they seize upon it.
We were vulnerable to that discourse, that hack, that going after education as an elitist activity. You know, we were very vulnerable to that and still in many ways are. And that's why maybe I think of Katie Porter, you know, and her whiteboards and like, okay, that's a teacher move. Everybody knows what a whiteboard is. You've now established that you are, you know, reliable.
She's the third grade teacher of your dreams.
Isn't and going she? After, you know, the villains, the corrupt, you know, all this stuff.
Here's what it takes to live. Yeah.
You know. But I don't know if you saw it out here because they ran a lot of here in California. But again, appropriation, the attack ads on her were moms holding up whiteboards saying, Katie Porter has not helped us. I can't afford groceries, you know, and just sheer attack, but appropriated her whiteboard. And I think you took a chunk out of her out here.
Huh. Well, I formulated some time ago that basically the core controversy here or issue is that the right or the Republicans, the conservative side, thinks that rich people will protect you from the government, and the left thinks that government will protect you from the rich people. And more or less, it shakes out that way. Tax the rich, tax the rich. They turned down our billionaire tax on creating kindergarten for all or whatever. So anyway.
I think it's a great line, and I like, you know, aphoristic lines like that everybody can.
Well, but it, you know, and maybe that's going to undergo some kinds of tests here. But I think that's basically because, you know, the big contradiction that the people on the go, how can, you know, these rich people aren't doing anything for you, what did Donald Trump do for you when he cut taxes? But there, you know, it's just core in that ideology that empowered rich people will protect us from all the damn fool things the government wants to do. You know, you quoted Reagan's line on it, but I think that's old. That's an old, you know, mentality. And of course, every sign of it. You know, you're think about all the stuff. And people don't even know what their parties are doing half the time because it does reduce down to these kinds of things. I was talking to a Republican the other day that did not believe that Republicans in general want to mess with Social Security. And you can look at over and over and over again the number of places and times where they do, right? We want to get rid of entitlements. And on the other side, every time you look at somebody took Social Security or Medicare out of my check, that's the government doing that, right?
Right.
So it is, you know, the great vilification of the government on one side versus the oligarchs on the other side.
Yeah, and that's what I say. Maybe at the big level, like holding on to those kind of big level strands and trying to get those, you know, to strengthen in people that, you know, maybe that's the rhetorical play instead of getting caught what I...
Well, what you're talking about does sound dangerously like education, Dan.
No. It's not
a rhetorical analysis that what they're saying and how they're, you know, reducing this to slogans doesn't really quite capture the nuances of policy and practice. Yeah.
Yeah. In the heteroglossia, you know, the big go, you know, return to go to jail, like the big instructions become super dominant, you know.
Well, you know, and once again, every, you know, different groups have their own way of kind of slicing up the pie because this is urban versus rural. And I think a lot of the problems and part of this sort of we win, who wins and who loses has to do with this red and blue map as a reductivity, right? There are Democrats, liberals living out there in those red states. And there are conservatives living right next to you in your blue city, right? It's not, you know, these are very small kinds of shifts, right? At the extreme, 60-40 or something like this, right?
Right.
No matter where you look, at the extremes. And it really converges closer than that most places, and depending on the time and the issue. So though, I think we've been sold that kind of dualism. Either orism or whatever, but it seems to me that the education split is as salient as anything here, and I think it's kind of changed over time. I don't know what the current figures are, but it you know, certainly it used to be 10-12 years ago when I was checking into these kinds of things, you know, Democrats and Republicans had about the same number of college degrees. Democrats had far more advanced degrees, specialists and right, those kinds of things, professors and people with other advanced degrees, but also more people with less than high school. I think that's probably changed, but you know, as an educator, I often kind of shake my head and say, we just didn't educate enough people in time.
Right.
Right. We tried. We really did.
We didn't inoculate enough of the population, enough, you know, needles in arms or in brains fast enough.
Pretty much. And I think that the educational split is because once again, we're getting back to what are you going to count as true and what do you believe? And do you have some sort of, you know, coherent, you know, the word integrity comes to mind, integrated system of discerning. I think that is the bulwark against the gurgling cauldron of heteroglossia. Yeah, with QAnon as kind of the daily menu of crapola, right? And you know, there are people over there just kind of surfing that this is sort of the
right
conspiracy.
Well, again, it's the educated moral with our machetes out there trying to hack our way through the, you know, the ugly heteroglossia that's being used against America.
But more and more that is seen and targeted as the enemy.
Right. Well, that's the game. Like anything you do that gets inroads, you're going to become villainized. And so to me, like when we play games of villainy, like, okay, to me, politics has become hyper villainy. like, can you make villainy stick? And I watched it, you know, once they got Hillary's emails, I'm like, oh, they've got a cancer. They've got a spear in the side of the Lord, and they're just going to twist that sucker. And it's not coming out. You know, it's never coming out. Like, that one is going to stick. And so I think Trump with January 6th was a bit of a spear in the side that they can twist. I don't think people still know what big lie means, but they do understand, it's kind of treason. That's kind of bad. And even though it fades over time, because people stop seeing the real images and not enough death, not enough, you know, highly active proof over time, it's still stuck. You know, still stuck enough that I don't think he's coming back. I think he's toast.
You think he's wounded, fundamentally wounded?
Yeah.
Everybody seems to be kind of betting that direction on both sides. I mean, the Republicans are kind of reading the signs that way, although, you know, he's like the Terminator or, you know, any of these other horror story things. He continues to resurrect, well, even at the last minute.
There are things he can still wreck. You know, he just may not be able to wreck Biden and the Democrats right away, but he can still wreck a lot.
And what changes when that happens? I mean, are Republicans going to turn back into something? I think they're fundamentally changed. I think they are a kind of a libertarian coalition. But what happens to this conspiracy culture? I really don't know. Just a plug, though, and I can't remember the woman's name, but conspiracychart.com is a beautiful thing. She says there's this kind of level, the upper stage of it is that elites are controlling the events of the world, right? And of course, the biggest part of that is, she says, the point of no return in conspiracy thinking is blaming Jews.
Right.
And we're there.
Yeah.
It's funny. John Stewart was on Colbert just the other night to talk.
Yeah, I watched the John Stewart thing today. And I tweeted last week that clearly Kyrie Irving needed more than 1 year at Duke. That 1 year and out may have been a problem for a multimillionaire, you know, with a public forum.
You know, once again, we know the symptoms of this, that people want a basis for simplification. They want to externalize, you know, their suffering, their perceived suffering. They want to be able to, you know, put their energies in the direction of, and scapegoating is, of course, the off the shelf version of that. So, is that going to end just because Trump leaves the picture? Are we going to get some new, an uglier version of that? So,
good question. I don't know. I think Trump raided most of the treasure troves in the cave of
slavery. Well, I don't know. DeSantis got where he is by simply being more Trumpy than Trump in that respect. He's not stupid and lazy, which are kind of the redeeming qualities.
He's also not as charismatic. So we'll see. We'll see what happens with him. But he doesn't have the
And as with all politics, you know, we would like to think that this stuff is predictable, but it's not.
No, not at all. There are always new things entering the header glossary that become, you know, useful that you can well up into, again, the same channels, like you said, scapegoating. That's a clear channel. The right likes it. Let's use it. We just need a good scapegoat, you know, and one.
And we know that change is tough. And you know, I was getting ready to say, you know, and once again, to me, the takeaway is that what we can take for granted is all of a sudden undergone change. More things are contingent and seem to be obviously resting on these outcomes. And, you know, there's kind of a happy version of that, which is, okay, you've been working for 40 years to get abortion, Roe v. Wade rejected, you got it. You've been trying to get the Supreme Court, you got it. You've been trying to, and at least by a margin this time, people voted against that, voted in favor of, you know, progress. So,
I think
what happens next, I think, is the interesting question.
It is, and I sometimes describe what the Republicans have done as gone in and eating the seed corn of democracy, like to go after the institutions, to go after the, you know, long-term commitments, to go after the...
They're not putting any legitimacy back into the bank.
Right. They're just going out and just, you know, extracting the energy and the value from the things that exist. And that will have its come to Jesus moment, because at some point.
I think come to Jesus. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, you know, well, where is my retirement? Like, who is going to take care of my, you know, that kind of.
Well, I think one of the fundamental wellsprings of this kind of libertarian psychosis, if you will, has to do, it does get back to 2008. And there is this sort of mythology out there that if we would just not fixed things, not bailed out, not, you know, got the Federal Reserve, not that natural order would have righted this thing. That markets would have reset, and something different would have sprung from the ashes. And I don't believe that in the least. You know, there are real depressions, and they last a long time until you have a world war. and we could have had one. The guy in charge of this was in fact an expert on exactly how that happened. So, it does seem like a slippery slope we're on in trying to continue to buy off that eventuality. But seriously, chaos, you know, once again, we take a lot for granted thinking that social order will sustain and, you know, you'll be able to afford your new pickup truck, and you'll be able to work half the time with a salary of $70,000 a year. And
right.
That will stay in place.
Well, just to finish up the last thing, like I did notice that like the McConnells, you know, the more traditional Republicans started to figure out how to stain the, you know, Tea Party extremist MAGAs with the word chaos. Like he literally said when they asked him, well, why'd y'all lose? He's like, well, I think a lot of our party was preaching chaos, you know, and nobody really wants chaos in this country.
So, well, I think McDonald's been caught telling the truth a couple of times. It's just nobody makes, it doesn't do them any good.
Right. Yeah.
They only blew him down.
That's gone. Well, cool. This was super fun. I enjoyed, you know, actually digging right at the political environment with rhetoric shovels.
Sure thing. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has. We will circle back around. Again, none of this is going away. That's for sure.
Right. It will just take its new form.
Yeah. In the heteroglossia. That's what the name of this one, title of this one is going to be.
All right. Talk to you soon.
So, all right. We'll see you next time. Come back soon. Check us out. This is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Get out there. Persuade others. They need persuasion.